Welcome to Attorney Heart, the podcast focused on bringing awareness to and promoting attorney well-being. Join Attorney Heart as you embark on a journey to improve the quality of your professional and personal life. And now, here's your host, Fernando Flores. Looking up, there's always sky. Rest your head, I'll take you
high. We won't fade into darkness. All right. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Attorney Heart. Thank you for joining me. I am really, really pumped about this next interview. Michelle Kuo, who I have known for many years now, and I have worked very closely back in, what was it, Michelle, 2010, 2011?
Yeah. Oh, my God. It was 8 years ago. And yeah. Fernando, I don't want to embarrass Fernando, but he was my mentor in workers' rights and tenants' rights law. We shared this tiny office space in this legit dilapidated building in Fruitvale, the Fruitvale District of Oakland.
Yeah,
Fernando taught me many things, how to negotiate with an employer, how to counsel a crying client. He taught me basic Spanish, and he didn't judge me for my poor Spanish. Yeah, so, I'm like very glad to have been brought into the Fernando magic along with his ridiculously talented wife Liz. They're just really want them to run for president. I don't know which one would be the better candidate, actually.
Probably Liz.
Probably.
Yeah, most likely.
You would be a really amazing first husband, though.
Yeah, right. Yeah. first husband ever. But Michelle, thank you so much for being on. And just so that our listeners know, Michelle is an assistant professor at the American University of Paris in the International and Comparative Politics Department, where she teaches in its History, Law, and Society program. Not only that, but she's also the author of this very, very powerful book that I finished reading a few weeks back. And it's called Reading with Patrick, a teacher, a student, and a life-changing friendship. It was published about a year ago, right, Michelle? Last July in 2017?
That's exactly right.
And I know that you are from Michigan originally. That's where you were born and raised. And so I want to start, because there's so many places that we can start in this particular podcast. But I want to start, Michelle, with just your background as an advocate for others, okay? And I'm gonna leave it very, very open-ended, you know. But in particular, you know, what was it that ultimately attracted you to do the work that you did out of law school? And tell us a little bit about what that work was, so that, you know, we can tell our audience what you got yourself into right after Harvard Law School.
So just to back up a little bit, my parents are from Taiwan. They're immigrants. I grew up in a western part of Michigan where there weren't many Asian immigrants. And they had a lot of expectations. They wanted me to be a doctor or to make money or to go into sciences and later into tech. I don't even think I appreciated at the time how much I'd internalized their expectations. So every step of the way in college, when I decided not to do pre-med, when I decided to become a teacher, when I decided to study social theory, it felt like such a large step of rebellion. Even though on paper, I think I seem perhaps not as much of a risk taker as I think it would be considered within a Taiwanese American community. So when I came out of law school, this tremendous life-changing thing happened to me in my third year of law school. I had been a teacher before I went to law school in a rural part of Arkansas. And when I decided to leave after 2 years of teaching, it really felt like a kind of crossroads in my life. I had had this really extraordinary student named Patrick. He's a subject, partly the heart of the book. I had found out in law school that he had gotten into a fight and killed somebody. So after law school, feeling quite devastated and lost, I decided to go back to Arkansas to help him with his legal case, to figure out what had happened, and also to go back to this place that I felt like I prematurely left. And yeah, and it was a bit of a crazy decision. Some would say irresponsible, because I had already had this job out in legal aid, the job where I met you. And my life was set, you know, I was supposed to start this job in California, but I just felt like I needed to go back to be with a student, to be in this place where very few people go. And it was a bit of a momentous decision. And at this point in my life too, I had figured out how to break away from my parents. I just realized I couldn't actually trust some of the advice they give, even though it was really well-intentioned and full of love. I stopped asking them for permission to make crazy decisions.
And Michelle, if I remember that particular period correctly from the book, you know, Patrick, who was your student in high school, right? He was in high school and you were out teaching in the Delta. He, when he got arrested, I mean, you were there within days, right, to meet up with him after you heard the news that he had been arrested for killing someone.
Yeah, within days.
It and happened was, oh, go ahead.
Yeah, so he was 19 when he was, sorry, he was 18 when he was arrested. And it was on a Wednesday. I got there on a Saturday. So I was seeing him right when he was still in shock about what happened and quite traumatized by the idea of what he had done, by the looming sense that his life would be totally different, that one night had changed his life.
And for you, at that point, had you already accepted the offer to go to California? Had you graduated at that point? Where were you in your stage in terms of finishing up with law school?
So that was September.
Okay.
And I was in my third year of law school, and I was still trying to figure out what I would do. I had gotten this offer from a corporate law firm, and I had made the mistake of telling my parents how much that offer was worth. note to all law students, do not tell your parents, especially if your parents are like mine. They've never really met a lawyer. They don't know anybody who lives in New York City. It just blows their mind. I don't blame them. It is an insane amount of money. But I had gotten this offer, and then I had also started to think about what public interest jobs I wanted. And these jobs are like really hard to get. They're actually more competitive than law firms when you're, you know, it's difficult to get a fellowship to work. I was thinking about criminal justice. I was thinking about legal aid. And I hadn't made a decision.
Had you determined, you know, what, you know, that you were going to end up just delaying, you know, starting to work at a legal aid organization? When was it that you ultimately made that decision?
I mean, it was really gradual throughout the year. I didn't even understand. I think we often don't fully know, like we're not fully conscious of how we're starting, of the path we're starting to take. But I had gone that Saturday when I found out, and he seemed utterly alone. He hadn't met his lawyer. He didn't want to hear about legal defenses because he felt like he had done what he'd done, even though there were really powerful legal defenses that he could have had. For instance, the guy who he killed was on his own property, was aggressive, was highly drunk, was with his younger sister, a minor, with a mental handicap. But he felt like he needed somebody. He had his parents, but they were also traumatized. When they went to see him in the jail, they were his mother was crying so much, he told her not to come. And I felt like I had broken a promise I made to him, because I had told him when he was doing really well in school that I would stay to see him graduate from high school. And then I had left. I'm always afraid when I talk about this, people will think, oh, you think you're such a savior, an outsider going in. But, you know, especially in rural areas where half the teachers are substitutes, where there's such a scarcity of adult professionals who help, right? Our school had no mental health counselor, no guidance counselor, but we had a police officer. We had no sports teams. People with means leave rural areas. The depopulation is radical. I mean, 50% of the population of the Delta has disappeared in the past 40, 50 years. Wow. So when you think about it from that picture of just a rural place lacking people, and then you add to that all the research that shows that high school dropouts are the people most likely to commit crime, it's not so crazy to believe that an adult-student relationship can make some difference, you know, in the child's life.
Well, I think also in the lives of other folks who end up reading your book, and in the lives of other students who learn from your book, you know, I'm sure your book has gotten a lot of attention. And one of the things that I really liked about reading with Patrick is how you end up really opening up, not just about Patrick, but about yourself, you know, and it really becomes this intimate story where you get to know both of the main characters really well. And when you snap back out of the book, you realize, okay, they're not characters, they're real people, you know. And it's like, I know Michelle, and you know, you definitely provide a very intimate story of who you are and your relationship to Patrick and how that developed and grew. And in a way, to me, I mean, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel that you also got to learn a lot about yourself as your relationship with Patrick developed.
Absolutely. I'm really glad you said that. Part of what was really important to me about the book was being really real about myself, my missteps in the classroom, about the limitations of a relationship that is incredibly unequal, right? There's so much power disparity between Patrick and me. And yet at the same time, to not lose hope in attempting to connect people. Mm-hmm. And what connects people, you know, it's when they both open up about themselves and their limitations. And so you see that happening throughout the book, where I say stupid stuff, where I make mistakes, where I have to tell Patrick and other students, I don't know you. Mm-hmm. I don't know you. I know I don't know you, but we're here today. I'm here tomorrow. I'm going to show up the day after that. And I think one thing that I wanted to convey in the book was that there is something really special and intimate and mysterious about art and about literature that connects us temporarily, fleetingly, where no person's interpretation of a line, no person's response or feeling in response to literature is superior to another person. And you feel that when Patrick is reading a poem and is telling me what it means to him. You feel that in how we read Frederick Douglass with totally different responses. His connection to it is powerful and full-blooded. So throughout the book, you see us trying to figure out our power, our disparity and our differences through literature. And I never shy away from talking about my own limitations. And that's like really important to me, because so much of the savior genre with a more privileged outsider coming in, I think they lose credibility because sometimes the narrators don't want to talk about themselves.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, from my perspective in reading the book, I definitely didn't. I understand that that's probably some of the, like, you know, commentary that you end up receiving, right? But I definitely didn't see that. And, you know, for my end, it was just more about how this relationship developed in a very genuine way and in a very just caring and compassionate way, you know? And I feel that that's just been a common thread of who you have been, Michelle. And ultimately, I got to see that firsthand when we worked at the nonprofit in Oakland together, Centro Legal, right? And, yeah. You know, and that was right before, I mean, you were with Patrick right before you started at the nonprofit, right? Mm-hmm. Was there anything from that experience that eventually carried over to how you ended up practicing law?
That's a great question. I mean, my immediate instinct is yes. Mm-hmm. But how? I mean, because there are so many differences between being a teacher and being a legal aid lawyer. As a lawyer, you're really putting out fires every day. And sometimes after you've really helped somebody, let's say, fight an eviction, sometimes your clients don't want to ever see you again. They're really grateful, but they're like, this was a painful episode in my life and our relationship has ended. And that makes total sense to me. That's how it should be. And that's one of the pleasures too of the profession, that you solve problems and the relationship ends after you've solved it. It's very matter of fact. And I think being a teacher is, it's really different. You do have a lifelong relationship with students. You shape them in ways you don't know. You don't know if you've actually solved some of their problems. It takes a life. You're just waiting sometimes to find out what impact you've had. Those are the immediate differences that strike me. Mm-hmm. But there's no question that when we're preparing clients, I almost said students, preparing clients for direct examination, for giving their testimonies, I thought of myself as a teacher. I thought about, how do I get this person to tell their story? The story has to be heard, that it deserves to be heard. How do we practice for this? How do I be encouraging? How do I not be so disciplinary and correctional as all professionals working with poor clients tend to be, right? We have even social workers and counselors, we have this disciplinary relationship with them, and it's very uncomfortable to have a position of authority around people who often know much more of life and have wisdom and have things to share.
And what would you say, Michelle, when you ended up, you know, practicing and representing clients, for you, you know, what would you say were some of the more challenging aspects of being an attorney?
Well, the hardest thing, I know exactly, the hardest thing about being an attorney is telling them that the law is not on their side. And you and I saw that all the time. Clients would come in not for wage theft, but for getting fired. We'd be searching for reasons. And oftentimes the person doesn't need to have a reason to fire somebody. They could just be a total jerk. That's really hard. Or if the law is just bad, like the law, some of the housing and rent control laws in the Bay Area are bad. They don't protect tenants. Can the landlord raise this rent on you? Yes, I'm really sorry. It's not fair. You know, activists are working on this, and you've done nothing wrong. I know that you've saved up for your family. You're a loving parent. There's just nothing I can do on this matter. And that's a terrible feeling, to feel powerless, because you get into this job because you have an idea that you can really help people.
Yeah. No, and I think that's definitely a reminder for me. Those were some of the more difficult conversations to have with clients, that look, this may seem unfair, but it's not necessarily unjust. And as much as I would like to tell you something different, there's just, you know, in your particular circumstance, there's nothing that we can do. I mean,
right. Yeah. Or to say this is unjust, and unfortunately the law is unjust, and I'm sorry that the law doesn't represent justice, you know, and I think that's really hard too.
Yeah.
You were amazing at that, Fernando.
Thanks, Michelle.
You were so good at just really helping clients feel like they're not alone, even when they were totally screwed over and had every good reason to feel alone, you know?
That's the thing. That's some of the things that I think I've picked up over the years of just, you know, being in the trenches. You know, I was in the trenches for a lot of years, working with a lot of clients day to day, week to week, month to month, and just every single day having so many conversations with so many clients. Like, we do more than just advocacy. We're, you know, we act as therapists, psychologists, consultants, you know, financial advisors, and at some points, you know, we just play so many different roles within the title of attorney that we don't give ourselves credit for, you know. And I feel like if you are able to develop some of those roles as you practice more and more, you know, and you get further into your professional career, I think it'll really benefit you, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And Michelle, How long did you end up practicing for before you decided to go back to teaching?
So I practiced for about 4 years, almost 4 years. I was at Centro Legal de la Raza with you, and then I clerked for a judge, and I was also doing some volunteer teaching at San Quentin Prison, which is the only college degree granting program. And then my husband got a job at the American University of Paris, and then this position at the History, Law, and Society program opened up about a year after he started. So it's been, I miss the pace. I mean, it was crazy how much we got accomplished in a day. You know, I miss that. I mean, not to brag about ourselves, but it was like, you get there, you call the employer, you get the check cut for the person, you know, $10,000 for his work gardening that he wasn't paid for. You call the landlord, you negotiate, you go to the court, you file the eviction defense, you know, then you meet with a client to talk about a case. And then by the evening, we have evening clinics. We were helping so many people at once. It was just it was amazing. I mean, I think burnout is highly possible, but the key thing that we had was we had colleagues and friends who were in on it with us. You know, it makes such a difference to feel like you have a community.
Yeah.
Community that's working just as hard as you and that is appreciating how much you're putting in. We had a really special community there.
Definitely. I don't know that I can keep up with that pace anymore, but
I know. I feel like I've gotten old. Maybe I'm like romanticizing those days. We were really tired the next day.
You know, I did want to ask you about that. You know, you maintain a very busy schedule. You're, you know, every time I see updates from you, you're everywhere, just, you know, talking about your journey and your book. Part of what I do on the podcast is definitely asking our guests, how do you try to maintain some balance as well? You know, it's, you're here, you're there, you're everywhere. What is it that you try to do to just try to maintain some balance in your life and maintain wellness and, or not, because you're just so busy. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I love that about your podcast, Fernando. I love that you're really trying to help people articulate strategies for taking care of themselves. And I have to say, I have had no strategy this year, and that has not worked well out for me. I had a really hard year. I felt like, feel like I gave too much of myself away. I for those people who are listening and work long hours, you know, the body knows. The body will tell you when you've pushed it to exhaustion. So this year, very recently, basically in the past 2 weeks, I've been asking myself, how do I have more calmness in my life? So I've experimented with a little bit of meditation each day.
Good.
And I think I plan to, we have a lot of evening events at my university, and I'm really going to try to be home in the evening more. Just learn how to prioritize my marriage, which sometimes we take that for granted when you're married to an amazing person, which I am. So I'm just like, oh, he'll always be there. And actually, you have to work on these things every day through time together. And I also just feel I haven't had a clear thought for a while, which is weird because I'm constantly speaking and teaching. So it's kind of scary to imagine. I feel bad for the students if I haven't had a clear thought. So how do I have more clear thoughts? You know, I lost my cell phone a month ago, just totally randomly. And I've been so much happier. I just am not on my phone scrolling at night or in the morning. I've read so many books this past month that I probably wouldn't have finished if I had had my phone. So I'm going to stay without phone. So these are all like small strategies, just meditation, really imagining what the ideal schedule would look like, creating time for things that really call me, that help me write better, which is reading. Mm-hmm. And Yeah, and just really listening to my body, you know.
Yeah.
Listening to my breath. I mean, there's just, I've had a lot of negative energy this year. Just, you know, I feel like slighted, or I feel unappreciated. And I just don't want to be that kind of person who's just, you feel those people, right? Immediately. Yeah. You when you're with them, you're just like, oh, and you want to help them, but they take up a lot of space. I just don't want to become that person. And we're all at risk of becoming that person. Maybe not you, Fernando. You're like, you've always been just on another level of transcendent calm. But for us mortals, it is very hard to not feel slighted and frenzied all the time. So I'm pretty excited about this new plan of mine to be calmer, you know, a little less of a sponge for everything. Yeah.
That's good, Michelle. I mean, I think, and I am perfectly susceptible to being flurried and not calm as
you
well.
You hide it really well. You can tell everybody about that. Well, we can all feel better about ourselves.
Well, I mean, a lot of it is, you know, what I talk about, you know, in terms of just developing that emotional awareness, you know, that emotional processing, you know, that ability to really understand what's going on internally, so it doesn't manifest, you know, inadequately against someone that doesn't deserve it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that is the worst feeling, right? That is the worst feeling when you realize you've just.
And you know, Michelle, yeah. A lot of times when we get into that zone and we feel, like you mentioned, slighted, or we are receiving negative energy and we don't know how to process it, who are we typically around? Our partner. And sometimes they end up getting the receiving end of energy that is not even because of them, about them, or anything. It's just that we don't know how to process it. And so they end up receiving something that they shouldn't. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you end up, you know, jabbing or doing something that's just not appropriate. And they're like, whoa, where did that come from? You know? And when that, whoa, where did that come from conversation comes up, it's because something obviously has been bothering you. And, and I'm not saying you, I'm saying the proverbial you. And yeah. You know, we haven't been able to process it, right? And so yeah. I think you raised really good points in terms of breathing, meditating, finding your centeredness and coming to that place of just the authentic you and staying grounded, you know, by silencing, you know, your surroundings, right? Your external surroundings and your internal ones, I think is really important. And it's hard for us to do. I mean, you're halfway around the globe and you're going through very similar things to folks that I'm talking to here in the Bay Area. You know what I mean? This is not, you know, unique to just one society or one profession, right? It's a very common problem. I mean, the one thing that ends up eating a lot of people up is worry. Just constantly worrying and worrying and worrying and worrying about things that don't even come to fruition, right? And so I think you bring an excellent points, Michelle, about just even if you go through a very, very busy period, you can still hit the pause button, and you should if your body's telling you to, right? Because if not, it's really going to come to a point where your body's just going to hit the brakes and you're not going to be able to move forward.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I you put that so eloquently. We really have to. I want to be just more open and present. And I don't want to be a complainer. I read this definition of complaining as just talking about things that you don't have control over. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to not complain.
You know, and here's the thing that I've learned too. We can complain, but a lot of times it's how you complain that matters. You can do it in a very, you know, positive ways, like, hey, you know what? I didn't like that. I'm not about that. Have a great day. I'm never going to see you again.
That's so great, but I'm going to do that just the way you taught me.
There you go. Yeah. Have a great day. Yeah, because, you know, if you don't make time to think through, okay, what kind of energy do I want around me, and what kind of energy do I want to give out, right? I was reading this article on fostering trust, and not just, you know, in your marriage, but just in any relationship. And it's really just these small day-to-day interactions, right? And it predominantly applies to your marriage, because, you know, that's who you end up having a lot of interactions with, or your kids, right? Or your relatives. But having these small, it's these small interactions that end up leading to the nurturing and fostering of love, right? Mm-hmm. Ultimately, at the end of the day, that's really what ends up building and creating love. You cannot just give a ton of love. It's fostered and nurtured and grown and, you know, watered with these small every day-to-day interactions. And I really love that perspective, because then it really puts the responsibility where it should be, which is on you. What are you doing every day to let that person that you chose to be with, you know, that you appreciate them, that you're there for them, you know, to communicate in their love language, and fill their love cup, as my wife likes to call it.
Fill your love cup. I love that. Yeah. I mean, I just don't, I'm married to somebody who's incredibly positive and nurturing, but I don't want all of his time in a day being spent tending to my slights, you know. It's like he has better things to do. So I mean, what you're saying is also really wonderful, because if it's really about small interactions each day, we have incredible power over minute by minute. That's pretty profound to think about. Mm-hmm. It removes some of the pressure.
Yeah. So Michelle, one other question, and I really appreciate your perspective, but one other question that I wanted to ask you, you know, for it's a two-part question. For anyone who is you know, interested, maybe they've been an attorney for a long time. I mean, you've done both work just as an educator, right? Before you went to law school, you worked as an educator. Then you worked as an attorney and an educator when you were teaching in San Quentin. And, you know, and then now you're back to, you know, a professor position, educating again at a university. You know, that's been a common thread, education, for you. For any attorney that's interested in potentially pursuing that, you know, and working at a university, what are some thoughts that and tips that you would, you know, provide to them? What are things that, oh, you know what, I didn't know I had to do that, or I didn't know that that was a requirement? What would you say, you know, to someone that's interested in getting into that particular area of education, or just in education?
Just so tips to lawyers who are thinking of going to education, is that?
Yeah, very okay. Well summarized, Michelle, much better than I asked the question.
Oh no, I just wanted to make sure, so I didn't give a totally irrelevant response.
No, you got it, yeah.
I don't know, I mean, lawyers honestly make natural teachers.
Mm.
They really do, and the reason why is because they understand that a jury is full of ordinary people who you have to reach. You know, a lawyer understands that you're trying to reach people with what they have and with what you have, and that you have to meet somewhere. And that's what a classroom is. People have to meet. It doesn't matter how smart you are. If you don't know how to reach each person where they're at, then you're not a teacher in my book. So, and I think lawyers get that. They get that. And the reason they get that is because the stakes are so high. If you can't meet the jury where they're at, if you can't meet the landlord employer in the negotiation, if you can't figure out what your client really wants, then game over, you know? Yeah. Hello, sheriff, taking out your life's belongings and putting them out in the street, you know? So I think the key is for the lawyer to channel that kind of energy in the classroom. I guess the flip side to this is that it's not adversarial. A classroom is not adversarial. Oftentimes, you are working together to reach a kind of truth, and that is different from, I think, the legal system, where somebody in the courtroom might actually be evil.
Yeah. Michelle, that raised another question for me in terms of like how you described that lawyers, one of the key qualities that can apply directly to being a teacher is reaching people, right? Just, I really like how you described that. One of the things that I saw online was a video of Patrick reading, "I Taught Myself to Feel Free," right? And that's a beautiful poem. And I wanted to ask you, you know, in terms of Patrick, what do you feel has been one of the greatest lessons that you've learned from him and that you feel you've taught him? And basically, what's the greatest lessons you've each learned from each other?
It's a hard question. I mean, there's so much I can say about this, but that we do have more in common as humans than we don't. I think we live in a time where it's fashionable for liberals to emphasize structural differences. And I totally agree with that. Obviously, the whole book is about historical oppression and structures of poverty and race. Mm-hmm. But in these moments of reading together, of writing together, of talking together, you can get closer. We can get closer. And when I say that we are closer, we have more in common as humans than we don't, it's a way of fighting, you know? And mm-hmm. That's something that I learned from him, because if I hadn't been so close to him, maybe I would have adopted a more fatalistic attitude. Maybe the book would have been purely a portrait of all of the oppressive laws and people rather than a portrait of one person making incredible gains with his literacy, with some small thanks to another person in his life, you know?
Yeah. You know? I love it, Michelle. That's powerful, definitely powerful. And if our listeners wanted to get a copy of your book, where can they find it, Michelle? Give us a little bit on that. Or if they wanted to reach out to you and talk to you more about your book, you know, how is it that they can connect with you? Tell us a little bit about that, and I'll make sure to include that information in the podcast show notes as well.
Thank you, Fernando. That's so nice. So you can find me, talk to me, tell me about yourself. I'm very open. I love hearing about where people are from. It's the best part of publishing, is getting to know people, getting to know readers who have stories to tell. So you can find me on Facebook and Twitter. Facebook is just my name. You'll see my picture and are like the author on the author page. And you can get the book really anywhere. You can ask your local bookstore. You can find it on IndieBound. You can find it on Barnes & Noble and Amazon. Cool. But I like to support independent bookstores. So if you have one nearby, go stop by. The paperback is out and it's more affordable than the hardback. And and you can message me on Facebook. On Twitter, I'm at KuoKuoMish, KuoKuoMish. So yeah.
Awesome, Michelle.
Yeah, give me a shout out.
Sounds good. Well, thank you for sharing that information. And I'll also make sure to include a couple links of you know, where folks can get the book, and we'll take it from there.
Okay. Thank you so much, Fernando. Thanks for your thoughtful questions.
Definitely, Michelle. Thank you for your time. And thanks everyone for joining us on another episode of Attorney Heart. Take care, Michelle. We'll be in touch.
Okay. Bye, Fernando. Thank you.
Okay. Bye. Hey everyone, before you go, I wanted to personally invite you to the I Matter Now 2018 conference. It's coming up August 18, 2018. It's going to be on a Saturday. It's one day of just awesome speakers related to everything from your health. How can you improve your health? We're going to have awesome doctors, naturopathic doctors who focus on making sure that holistically you are well and that you are fostering wellness in your life. They're going to bring some really great strategies and tips for you to consider. We're going to have entrepreneurs who have built their wealth in real estate, so that if you have, you know, certain money set aside and you're trying to figure out, how do I grow this? How do I make it, you know, how do I make it more, right? You can definitely figure out different ways to do that. And we're going to have also attorneys who are going to talk about productivity and making sure that you are taking care of yourself throughout the day and how that directly impacts your ability to be productive throughout the day, and also how you can potentially build your legacy. And our speakers are just going to be really, really great. And I hope that you make time on Saturday, August 18th to join us in San Francisco at the Hyatt Regency. And I look forward to meeting up with you then. Thank you again for listening in to Attorney Heart. And I, again, if you have any questions about the conference or to register, just go to imatternowconference.eventbrite.com. Again, imatternowconference.eventbrite.com. imatternow is imatternow conference.eventbrite.com. All right. Thank you so much. Catch you at the next one. Bye.
Hi, everyone. Fernando here again to thank you for listening in to another Attorney Heart episode. If you like this episode, please make sure to give it a thumbs up, and if it can benefit anyone that you know, please share it. Attorney Heart is brought to you by iMatterNow, I-M-A-T-E-R-N-O-W. Please make sure to check our website at imatternow.com, again, I-M-A-T-E-R-N-O-W.com, and join iMatterNow's Facebook page. Follow us for future events and additional resources. Every day presents an opportunity to engage in self-care. And remember that it is not selfish to take care of your well-being. It is necessary. So, take care and connect with you on the next Attorney Heart episode.